Practice Test 7, Part 3. In this part, you will hear two segments from a radio program. After each segment, you will hear six questions about it. Before each segment begins, you will have time to preview the questions. You will hear each segment twice. Then you will hear the questions once. If you want to, you may take notes as you listen. You should mark A, B, or C. Do you have any questions? Look at the questions, then listen to the first segment. Now you will hear the first segment.
What would you do in a situation where someone needs help? The human impulse to help someone is very strong, but today, people are often afraid to become involved. Bob Morris reports.
Some people will always help an accident victim, while others won't even lift a finger or a phone. Apparently, one of the major factors governing our behavior in such situations is how others behave. Dr. Harriet Carter, a psychologist who studies group dynamics, has some interesting insights to share with us.
Several years ago, a middle-aged woman was walking along a busy street in a big city at lunchtime when she fell and broke her leg. Hundreds of people stopped for a moment to look at her and then just continued on their way. The woman lay there in pain and shock for almost an hour. No one came to her assistance. Why did these bystanders fail to help? Are we indifferent to the suffering of others? Research into this phenomenon has shown that the amount of assistance a victim receives depends on the number of people in the vicinity. In other words, the more people who witness the distress of a victim, the less likely the victim is to receive help. We conform to the behavior of the crowd, a phenomenon referred to as the bystander effect, where the individual's actions or opinions are sacrificed to the conventions or the norms of the behavior of the group.
But imagine arriving 5 minutes after the woman fell. You see her on the ground, people ignoring her. How do you define the situation? Is she homeless or a drunk? She might be an actress on a reality show. You're reluctant to make a fool of yourself. You may suspect it's a diversion so you can be robbed. You take your cue from others and just continue walking. Dr. Carter, it makes you wonder, is there a difference in behavior in different places, such as small towns as opposed to large cities?
Oh, there is, definitely. Recent research in Florida has shown that people in small towns are more likely to help. As soon as one individual breaks the mold, more people are likely to do so. Perhaps it's because people in small towns have a greater sense of community. They're more sympathetic to others and less afraid to intervene. Individuality is the key. By definition, conformism implies following the crowd and is therefore the antithesis of creative action or innovative leadership. As a result, it opposes change and progress within a group. Conformism implies that individuals are more socially acceptable when they blend into their surroundings. They don't stand out in any way as abnormal, eccentric, or unusual.
So you're saying that individuals who want to modify group behavior must act, that the change must come from within society. One view of innovation is to be seen to conform to the conventions of the group, but to make minor, gradual acts of non-conforming behavior to bring about change. In this way, the group feels less threatened. Change is not seen as radical and thus is accommodated by the group. And over time, change is indeed affected.
Now you will hear the segment again.
What would you do in a situation where someone needs help? The human impulse to help someone is very strong. But today, people are often afraid to become involved. Bob Morris reports.
Some people will always help an accident victim, while others won't even lift a finger or a phone. Apparently, one of the major factors governing our behavior in such situations is how others behave. Dr. Harriet Carter, a psychologist who studies group dynamics, has some interesting insights to share with us.
Several years ago, a middle-aged woman was walking along a busy street in a big city at lunchtime when she fell and broke her leg. Hundreds of people stopped for a moment to look at her and then just continued on their way. The woman lay there in pain and shock for almost an hour. No one came to her assistance. Why did these bystanders fail to help? Are we indifferent to the suffering of others? Research into this phenomenon has shown that the amount of assistance a victim receives depends on the number of people in the vicinity. In other words, the more people who witness the distress of a victim, the less likely the victim is to receive help. We conform to the behavior of the crowd, a phenomenon referred to as the bystander effect, where the individual's actions or opinions are sacrificed to the conventions or the norms of the behavior of the group.
But imagine arriving 5 minutes after the woman fell. You see her on the ground, people ignoring her. How do you define the situation? Is she homeless or a drunk? She might be an actress on a reality show. You're reluctant to make a fool of yourself. You may suspect it's a diversion so you can be robbed. You take your cue from others and just continue walking. Dr. Carter, it makes you wonder, is there a difference in behavior in different places, such as small towns as opposed to large cities?
Oh, there is, definitely. Recent research in Florida has shown that people in small towns are more likely to help. As soon as one individual breaks the mold, more people are likely to do so. Perhaps it's because people in small towns have a greater sense of community. They're more sympathetic to others and less afraid to intervene. Individuality is the key. By definition, conformism implies following the crowd and is therefore the antithesis of creative action or innovative leadership. As a result, it opposes change and progress within a group. Conformism implies that individuals are more socially acceptable when they blend into their surroundings. They don't stand out in any way as abnormal, eccentric, or unusual.
So you're saying that individuals who want to modify group behavior must act, that the change must come from within society. One view of innovation is to be seen to conform to the conventions of the group, but to make minor, gradual acts of non-conforming behavior to bring about change. In this way, the group feels less threatened. Change is not seen as radical and thus is accommodated by the group, and over time, change is indeed effected.
Number 39. What does Dr. Carter imply was surprising about the woman's accident? Number 40. What did researchers learn about people's behavior? Number 41. According to Dr. Carter, how does the bystander effect explain this behavior? Number 42. How does city size influence the bystander effect? Number 43. What does the reporter say about how to effect change? Number 44. What is the main purpose of this report? Look at the questions. Then listen to the second segment. Now you will hear the second segment.
There are various ways of dealing with troubled children. Kate Harvey reports on a program which takes problematic kids from inner cities out into the wilderness.
Wilderness camps are nothing new. You take a group of people out into the country and let them fend for themselves. They learn survival techniques, but more importantly, such experiences foster the development of vital social skills such as teamwork and self-assurance. With me today to talk about work in the wilderness with severely troubled children are Mark Carson, who is a counselor at a long-term therapeutic wilderness camp in Texas, and Emma Barnes, who spent 2 years as a youth in such a camp. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the invite.
Mark, can you give the listeners a brief description of how these camps work?
Sure. Therapeutic wilderness camps are for boys and girls who, because of drug or alcohol addiction or extremely antisocial behavior, would otherwise wind up in juvenile detention centers. Each camp has no more than 10 campers and 2 counselors, and the participants live there from 1 to 3 years. It sounds like a long time, but acquiring skills and dealing with personal issues is a slow process. Campers learn to take care of themselves, doing things like cooking and cleaning. There's no electricity, which of course means no TV, no radio, no video, and so on. Wilderness camps do have formal educational programs, but the main emphasis is on rugged and challenging activities such as backpacking, cross-country skiing, and rappelling. We believe that an adventurous yet disciplined framework is the right environment in which to introduce therapy.
Do you agree, Emma?
Absolutely. I'm living proof that the correct framework and approach is being used. However, for me, the main reason that the therapy is effective is because drugs and alcohol are unobtainable. This means that the wilderness is free of the complications and traps of the kids' home environments. What's more, the challenges encountered on wilderness expeditions build self-esteem, and daily interaction fosters the ability to cooperate with others. This all helps to prepare the youngsters for their return to normal life in society.
How do you quantify the success of such programs, Mark?
Well, we monitor the children's behavior after returning home. There are various parameters. Have they re-entered school? Have they stayed out of jail for 1 year? Our average success rate is 80%, whereas in a regular youth detention center, 75% of troubled adolescents revert to their antisocial behavior. That's a success rate of only 25%, not a very satisfying figure. You see, removing these young people from unhealthy environments allows them to break their pattern of destructive behavior. The wilderness provides the perfect setting to achieve this goal.
Mark, when we talked earlier, you mentioned boys and girls. Did you find any differences in the results based on the gender of the participants? And in what areas did participants feel they benefited most from a wilderness camp?
In our latest ongoing study, no significant gender difference was found in the participants' success. After they finished the camp, we asked all participants to fill out a questionnaire. This indicated the areas in which kids felt they had benefited most and learned valuable skills. These included, in order of importance, communicating within the family, controlling a bad temper, staying out of legal trouble, managing studies at school, and staying clear of drugs.
Now you will hear the segment again.
There are various ways of dealing with troubled children. Kate Harvey reports on a program which takes problematic kids from inner cities out into the wilderness.
Wilderness camps are nothing new. You take a group of people out into the country and let them fend for themselves. They learn survival techniques, but more importantly, such experiences foster the development of vital social skills such as teamwork and self-assurance. With me today to talk about work in the wilderness with severely troubled children are Mark Carson, who is a counselor at a long-term therapeutic wilderness camp in Texas, and Emma Barnes, who spent 2 years as a youth in such a camp. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the invite.
Mark, can you give the listeners a brief description of how these camps work?
Sure. Therapeutic wilderness camps are for boys and girls who, because of drug or alcohol addiction or extremely antisocial behavior, would otherwise wind up in juvenile detention centers. Each camp has no more than 10 campers and 2 counselors, and the participants live there from 1 to 3 years. It sounds like a long time, but acquiring skills and dealing with personal issues is a slow process. Campers learn to take care of themselves, doing things like cooking and cleaning. There's no electricity, which of course means no TV, no radio, no video, and so on. Wilderness camps do have formal educational programs, but the main emphasis is on rugged and challenging activities such as backpacking, cross-country skiing, and rappelling. We believe that an adventurous yet disciplined framework is the right environment in which to introduce therapy.
Do you agree, Emma?
Absolutely. I'm living proof that the correct framework and approach is being used. However, for me, the main reason that the therapy is effective is because drugs and alcohol are unobtainable. This means that the wilderness is free of the complications and traps of the kids' home environments. What's more, the challenges encountered on wilderness expeditions build self-esteem, and daily interaction fosters the ability to cooperate with others. This all helps to prepare the youngsters for their return to normal life in society.
How do you quantify the success of such programs, Mark?
Well, we monitor the children's behavior after returning home. There are various parameters. Have they re-entered school? Have they stayed out of jail for 1 year? Our average success rate is 80%, whereas in a regular youth detention center, 75% of troubled adolescents revert to their antisocial behavior. That's a success rate of only 25%, not a very satisfying figure. You see, removing these young people from unhealthy environments allows them to break their pattern of destructive behavior. The wilderness provides the perfect setting to achieve this goal.
Mark, when we talked earlier, you mentioned boys and girls. Did you find any differences in the results based on the gender of the participants? And in what areas did participants feel they benefited most from a wilderness camp?
In our latest ongoing study, no significant gender difference was found in the participants' success. After they finished the camp, we asked all participants to fill out a questionnaire. This indicated the areas in which kids felt they had benefited most and learned valuable skills. These included, in order of importance, communicating within the family, controlling a bad temper, staying out of legal trouble, managing studies at school, and staying clear of drugs.
Number 45. According to Mark Carson, who goes to therapeutic wilderness camps? Number 46. What does Mark Carson say the main emphasis of the therapeutic camps is? Number 47. Why does Emma Barnes think that the therapy is effective? Number 48. According to Mark Carson, What is one way the success of the program is measured? Number 49. In which area did participants feel they had benefited most? Number 50. What is the main purpose of the talk? End of listening test.